Welcome to Ink and Quill, a podcast that examines works of literary fiction from the popular to the obscure. For the next hour, your hosts will discuss their thoughts on a novel, its author, and any subtext that they found particularly potent. Ink and Quill, turning literature inside out.
And welcome back to Ink and Quill.
Hi.
This is Fizz and Dr. Fizz,
Hot
Fizz.
Fizzy and, Hot.
We are at episode 21 this week, Nine Kinds of Naked by Tony Vigorito.
What a great title.
For those of you who have been listening along, you will remember that Tony Vigorito's first book, Just a Couple of Days, was our inaugural episode. This would be his second offering.
We can't get away from him. We cannot get enough of him.
Last time I spilled the beans just a little bit that there would be a surprise, and the surprise is that
drum roll
unofficially. Mr. Vigorito has agreed to do an interview on Ink and Quill. Unofficially.
I'm so sorry.
So, you know, we're obviously going to be looking more into that in the coming weeks and months. Obviously, an up-and-coming young rising star in authorship.
Yes,
he's
wonderful.
Very busy.
Mm-hmm.
So we will be respectful of his time and try to make it possible for an interview to take place. But he has unofficially agreed.
Yes.
So there's your payoff on the surprise from last time.
Yeah, he did tell me pretty much any time. Just let me know.
All right. And so we'll be coordinating schedules and trying to get that in.
Coming up soon.
Now, you know, I did want to kind of say as we start to get into this, that reviewing a book like Nine Kinds of Naked is kind of bittersweet for me. It's almost a review I hate to do, only because the book is so good, and it's better, so much better than the first book.
Which was already good.
That it ends up making it sound like the first book was crap, when it wasn't. I mean, those of you listening to the episode, we loved Just a Couple of Days and think the world of Tony Vigorito and his writing. But Nine Kinds of Naked is just off the charts in comparison. He just blows the lid off the book.
Now we're groupies. I mean,
absolutely.
Now the first question I really want to ask him is, so when is the third one coming up?
Right, yeah. When can we expect your next book? Is it just me, or did it seem like there's a line in Nine Kinds of Naked that almost hints at the title of a third book?
Yes, I mean, I think he's already working on something, you know. I mean, you would just, you
so
know.
I will just say, obviously I have no confirmation of this is just from reading Nine Kinds of Naked, but
sure.
I would not be surprised at all if there are, in the not too distant future, there is a third book by Tony Vigorito called something along the lines of Love and Other Pranks.
Yeah,
it would not be surprising to me at all.
Absolutely.
So what did you think in general?
Oh, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. This is not an easy read by any stretch. You know, this is a hard, this is deep, this is profound. So you sit with this book and, you know, you have the story and you also have the depth of it. I mean, this is highly philosophical. This is extremely interesting. You know, he taps on a lot of ideas, you know, from science to philosophy. He refers to a lot of the classics, you know, and a lot of the culture as well. So it's very rich, rich novel.
Yeah, I would agree. The language usage is...
it's impeccable.
Is very, very good. And definitely not amateurish as far as, you know, the reader is concerned. You may need to grab the thesaurus or the dictionary.
He loves the sound. I mean, you can really tell, you know, he plays not only with the language in the sense that he uses really the appropriate word. I mean, the guy knows the thesaurus by heart.
Right.
But he really likes alliterations, you know. I mean, he's always, you know, tickled by sounds. You can really tell, you know, he plays with sounds a lot.
Absolutely.
He plays with songs a lot, like he did in the first one, but those are even more intricate.
Right. And I did notice a much heavier use of alliteration in this book than his first one. Well, even in the title itself, you know, Nine Kinds of Naked, playing with N's and K's.
Yes.
There's just a lot of that all throughout the novel.
And it's really a search for the word, you know. I mean, you can really tell that he has spent some time not picking up the first word that comes into his mind, but really have done some search to find the word that will fit with the one before and the one after.
Yeah, and I would say that's probably an accurate assessment. I mean, we'd have to get confirmation from him on that. For all we know, it just was stream of consciousness, but... he really seemed to pay a lot more of attention to the turn of a phrase in this book than the first one. Not that he did poorly in just a couple of days, but there's definitely a lot more quipping going on in Nine Kinds of Naked than there was in just a couple of days.
And it's very deep, like I said earlier. It's extremely deep, but it's also extremely funny. I mean, the jokes are hysterical. You know, the sentences here and there, and it catches you unaware. So it's not... You know, it's not really a joke per se, but it's wink. You know, it's lovely.
Yeah, just not to make this Quipfest 2010, but we were talking earlier before the show. One of my favorite lines in the book is when a tornado lands a giant bronzed crucifix in the back of. Guy's pickup truck, and he relaxes because he realizes that God is with him. I just think that's hilarious.
I mean, just hilarious.
You know, again, just using the turn of the phrase to really bring some great humor.
Much Ado About Something. You know, there's always a reference to an author or to a book or anything else.
If we can turn to that dreaded word, critic, for a moment, I find it interesting that critics tend to. Respond to Vigarito's work by saying that they feel that it's dark. Because I don't really feel that. I don't even really think the themes are all that dark. Frankly, I think they're fairly bright. I mean...
Well, it's fairly bright. I think what they mean by that, as opposed to thinking dark in a sense of, Dickens, when you're dealing with,
that's what I'm thinking. I'm like,
sewage of London, I mean, this is not what... Probably what they mean by dark, what I would think, top of my head, would be he's dealing with serious themes. He's dealing with, life and death, and he's dealing with... the nature of mankind and where are we going and where are we going, where are we coming from and where are we going. So this is probably what they mean by dark, not darkness necessarily, but serious as opposed to light.
I just
topics.
Know that in the light, language manner of a critic trying to speak to the everyman about a book that they're reviewing. To call a book dark is telling the reader that it's going to have a macabre feeling to it. And there's just none of that in any of Vigarito's work. I don't experience that. So, maybe they mean it from a more scholarly perspective. But considering that most critics that work for, magazines and the media tend to be glorified food critics. I highly doubt it. I highly doubt it's a scholarly comment. And I think that for whatever reason, they consider contemplating the downfall of society, but looking at a positive way to deal with it is somehow dark to them. So I don't know. But I just find it weird. I find it interesting that they choose to describe his work. Not, I wouldn't say frequently, but at least consistently. There's a critic out there every time that seems to consider his work dark, and I find that interesting.
Yeah, I think they probably mean serious,
I would not never categorize anything that he is, anything in these either of these novels as dark. Humorous certainly and positive definitely. He's dealing with adult themes. Well, he's not a children's writer. Yeah, what do you want?
Hallelujah, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, he's dealing with, adult themes and, things that affect people on a very real level. I guess the situations and the philosophies that he's dealing with are very poignant, and they're very,
and I think that's what they mean.
You know, in your face, but yep. they're not dark. I wouldn't say that. So
and I
what,
think this
whatever.
Is what they mean. You know, I mean, wrong word maybe but I think this
maybe,
is what
I
they
guess.
Mean.
Yeah. So.
So to me, this is Alice meets the butterfly effect. We're talking of chaos theory. We're talking of law of probability or improbability. We're talking of 6 degrees in separation. You know, we're talking about quantum theory revisited. We're talking about, you know, happenstance. We're talking about different ways of looking at life, you know, through the eyes of a gathering of characters that we'll go through in a minute. And it's like you said, I mean, it's not light, but it's taken from a positive point of view. We have a problem. Humanity has got a problem. How are we going to fix it? And, you know, unlike Ishmael, you know, where Ishmael was giving you, we have a problem, and what needs to happen in order to solve that problem is to do something. You know, I mean, what kind of action can we take? And here, he's not a preaching guy. He's not telling you, well, this is what, you know, society needs to do. He's just basically telling you that you need to change your attitude. And I think this is very refreshing. I like that.
Well, yeah, I do find it rather different. It's the idea of the, you know, that realism is basically finely honed perception.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you change your perception, you change your own reality.
Absolutely.
Not in a tangible sense, but in an emotional sense. As opposed to, you know, the more hardcore Eastern thought and philosophy, which states that literally you will change your physical reality through changing your perception. Though he plays with those concepts in the text, in the end, the idea is merely just to change your frame of mind to better your own experience of life.
And it comes from him. I don't know if you had a chance to just browse, you know, his website, which I go to regularly just because I'm a freak. But I mean, he's describing an anecdote which I believe, although he doesn't exactly say that, but I believe is the, you know, the source of that book. And basically it's he was going to go on a bike ride, and he hesitated at the door thinking, should I wear a helmet? Shall I not? You know, what do I do? And he hesitated a little too long, and then he decided to go without the helmet. And so he went on a bike ride, and lo and behold, he got into a crash with a car, you know, and he was undergoing surgery or whatever. I mean, he had a lot of scratches. And the bike was fine. And I think that opened him up to the idea was, well, then hesitation is bad. I should just go with the impulse, you know, go with what I want to do and be done with it and avoid the chaos. You know, chaos comes from hesitation. And it's a brilliant point.
I think you meant that the other way around.
What did I say?
Because chaos is supposedly the positive thing. So chaos is the good thing.
And chaos is a good thing.
And order is the bad thing. So if you, you know, if you hesitate, then you go with order,
yes,
which ends up being
bad.
Your downfall.
And that's bad.
Last thing I think I'll say about Vigorito before we get into the text itself is that, to me, it seems like Vigorito is a nice, refreshing change from the average writer out there today.
Mm-hmm.
But I would, if I had to label Vigorito, which I don't particularly like to label, but if I had to give him a title, I would say that Vigorito is probably the best I've seen currently at teaching, for lack of a better word, Eastern philosophy to the Western mind.
Yes.
He's very good at translating, you know, Eastern philosophies and Eastern style thinking.
But making it cool, making
to
it
the,
funny.
To the Western mind that has never been exposed necessarily to those types of ideas and therefore has a hard time understanding it or seeing where it's coming from, I would say Vigorito does a fantastic job of translating those ideas into concepts that we readily grasp in the Western world.
But it's not an easy book. I mean, this is not
no.
a book that I would suggest to my students, to be honest with you. I mean, I love them to death, but somebody who doesn't have that kind of maturity is not necessarily going to grasp, because it's not easy at all, you know? I mean,
right.
There's passages and passages where really you can have to sit down and think, you know? I mean, it's not the kind of book where you get out, you know, after an hour of reading with a headache, but it's the kind of book you get out after an hour and you're exhausted.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think we should belabor that point. We're not trying to tell people don't read the book.
No, go read.
Because you're going to have to, it's going to be way too intense for you and you're going to have to think too hard. That's not the truth. It's just that the idea is this is not Twilight.
No, it's not.
You know, this is not Harry Potter. This is a real book. And so you're going to have to use your brain when you read this book, which is the way it should be. But yeah. In my opinion, books, you know, good books are the ones that actually make you think and make you evaluate your life as you read them.
Yes. Mirrors of the self.
So I would say Vigorito is dead on that, on this book. And I would say that it's definitely a grand slam home run
yep.
on this one.
Absolutely. Thumbs up.
So with that, we will go to break and we'll be right back to get into spoilers.
Don't move.
Don't touch that dial. Ink and Quill will be right back after these messages.
This is a podcast, not radio.
Oh, sorry. Don't touch that iPod. Ink and Quill will be right back after these messages.
What if they're using some other MP3 player?
Fine. Don't touch that MP3 player.
Straight download to PC or Mac?
You know what? We'll be back.
Are you troubled by irregularity? Then listen to Access Denied, Humans Defective. 9 out of 10 doctors say you'll shit yourself every time. Access Denied, Humans Defective. Download it from iTunes or directly from the show website at accessdeniedradio.com.
The Paranormal. Book reviews. Current events comedy. You can find shows on these topics and more at spookylogistics.com. You could even add your own show to the list of Spooky Logistics affiliates. We have something for everyone. SpookyLogistics.com, your first stop for internet podcasting.
Do you ever wonder who really built the Great Pyramid? Have you seen shadows moving out of the corner of your eye and need an explanation? If so, then you need Eerie Radio. A unique combination of informative interviews and hilarious antics, Eerie Radio tackles the paranormal in a way that's never been done before. Download the show from your favorite podcatcher or listen live at SpookyLogistics.com on Sundays at 7 p.m. Eastern. Eerie Radio. Listen, learn, laugh.
Haven't heard enough from your favorite podcasters, eh? Insatiable sons of boy, have we got just the thing for you. Hop on over to SpookyLogistics.com and sign up for the Spooky Asylum. As an Asylum member, you'll get access to all kinds of VIP content. Maybe then you'll be happy you greedy pieces of show your support to the spooky community of podcasts by joining the Spooky Asylum today.
The Spooky Asylum. Remember, the men in the white coats are your friends.
Hi there, folks. I'm Pastor Recoil, and I'm here to share with you a message about bacon. Because I like bacon. And do you know who else likes bacon? Seder, over at the-bunker.net. So if you like bacon too, check out Transmissions from the Bunker at the-bunker.net.
And we're back.
Yay!
So what do you got?
Oh, I got so many things you wouldn't believe it. Starting with characters, just to have an idea who those people are, what are we talking about? The first one, and I think the most important one to some extent, is Elizabeth. Elizabeth is a young girl in her early 20s, and she was born during the tornado night, you know, while the tornado hit, her mother gave birth to her in church.
And under a pew.
Under a pew. you know, when everybody else was stock naked. And so Elizabeth has got a rather interesting view of life, you know. I mean, she's here to experience. She's a stripper because she thought that, you know, getting diploma is a wonderful idea and it's going to, you know, first of all, it's going to get you in debt and then you're going to have to find a job you don't want in order to pay that debt. So you're going to be miserable forever. So might as well enjoy your life. So she becomes a stripper. Because, let's face it, she has very large boobs. So, it's true. She has, so she's, you know, called Baby Boob, and she is, you know, picked on as growing up. And then she uses it, you know, for her own purposes as she grows up. And she has that wonderful view of life, you know, it's all about experience, it's all about thinking, it's all about reflecting on yourself and the world. And she's you know, an extremely brilliant child. And so that's Elizabeth on one hand. You also have Diablo. Diablo is also a very interesting character, and he's kind of the, you know, the one that functions with her in the book. You know, I mean, they meet later, but Diablo is an ex-con. You know, he's a ex-prisoner, and he also has a rather interesting view of life. You know, it's also all about experience, and it's all about, you know, the impulse and everything. So you have those two main characters that really take on the show. And then we have your and my personal favorite too, which is Clovis.
Yes.
Now, Clovis is this 9th century man. I mean, we're talking 9th century, so, you know. Who?
He's a peasant. He's a peon.
He's a peasant, and he, you know, he's the kind of guy that will go against order every chance he gets.
What, middle level serf?
Yeah, something like that. And you know, lost his wife, lost his kid, so he's alone in the world. And
accused of witchcraft.
Accused of witchcraft, yes, like you do. And he stumbles about someone called Jacob. Help me on that one. I can't pronounce that.
Jacob Jingleheimer.
Jacob Jingleheimer. That's a hard one. And he ends up becoming King of the Woods.
Yes.
And King of the Woods signify in this book that you have perfect control of time, literally, that you can travel through time and you can do whatever you want with a certain set of, you know, small rules dictated by groups of gnomes.
Which are debatable at best.
Which are debatable, too. Yes.
Which I find humorous.
Oh, absolutely. But he has that ability to just, you know, move around time and just, you know, show up in your life and you see him the way that you want to see him, you know? I mean, you see him as a reflection of yourself or you see him as, you just don't see him. You see whatever you want to see, which is highly philosophical in itself. And so you have that character who is, you know, dealing with the gnomes and being that kind of omnipresence throughout the novel.
Right.
Coming and going and interacting with the 21st century on a regular basis and bringing, you know, chaos and order in the lives of the people who just live their everyday lives.
One of the things that I appreciate about the Clovis Jacob Jingleheimer situation.
JJ.
Yes. That not only are they representative of the Tao, which is obvious. I mean, it's pointed out literally in the text by referring to them as, you know, yin to yang, which the entire text is reminiscent of Taoism.
Oh, yeah.
At its base philosophy. But Jacob Jingleheimer is, for those who are not American or didn't grow up like a normal American, is from the children's song, John Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt. And the whole, that entire reference really points to the infinite loop. That's what that, because it's related to other children's songs, like This Is the Song That Never Ends, you know, and other songs that literally don't have to end. That the child basically continues singing it until they just get so sick of it that they don't want to do it anymore because it doesn't end. And that's most appropriate, I think, to that character. And I, in certain ways, I consider them to be the same character, just different personalities of the same character. And they are the infinite loop with one another. And I found that very, very cool.
Absolutely.
I greatly appreciated the analogy and the name and everything going along with that.
What I really appreciated is the character, because really it's a personification of Laughing Jim. Laughing yes. Jim is a hurricane. You know, I mean, you start the book with a tornado,
it's
you know.
A hypercane.
It's a hypercane. And you know, you start the book with a tornado. So, you know, the tornado happens.
A gentle breeze.
A gentle breeze that turns into a tornado, which obviously clearly refers to, you know, the wings of the butterfly on one side of the universe, of the, not the universe, the planet, you know, brings a tornado on the other side. You know, the chaos theory. And this is what you have here. You know, you have the gentle breeze and then suddenly it turns into a tornado. And this tornado really is the center, you know, it's the beginning of everything. You know, that's what not really create the birth of Elizabeth, but to some extent, yes. And creates the quest of, you know, the cherry shit that we'll talk about in a minute. And you know, and Diablo and everything that happens to him after that. So this is, you know, this is the beginning comes from the tornado, and then you have, you know, as a consequence or as a parallel or as, you know, something that has nothing to do with anything, if you want to see it that way, you have that hurricane that hovers above New Orleans. You have that huge hurricane that they have named Laughing Jim, which doesn't move. It does not rotate. It does not go anywhere. It is just staying there.
It merely supports an orange day clover.
and it's wonderful because that exact element right there is the key for people to start changing their behavior. I mean, they're reacting towards, you know, themselves and each other in light of the fact that this tornado is just staying there. And it's an interesting, you know, fact of life that it seems that Vigorito is trying to say that if you don't have anything to push or to help, you know, humanity do something, and they don't do anything, so you have that, you know, stupid hurricane just staying there, but it creates such an impulse, you know, such a reaction from mankind over there that just come and stay in New Orleans and just become happy, you know. They just look at it and they're happy.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting, you know, that you have that that meteorology element that is supposed to be devastating that really creates joy.
Yeah. Yeah, I really I was, you know, fascinated by the whole, you know, because he spends quite a bit of the book, frankly, talking about wind and
yes.
meteorology and tornadoes and hurricanes. And then these theoretical hypercanes and,
yes.
and other things along those lines. And I found all of that very interesting. And he obviously did a lot of research, I'm assuming, in order to come up with that kind of thing. But then using, you know, I guess I like the pretty much under the covers style implications that these chaotic wind patterns
mm-hmm.
create so much power, and that power can be transformed into whatever you want it to be.
That's the idea.
You know, and so therefore it is fueling a, you know, an almost, you know, he calls it in the book evolutionary, but I would say more, you know, that it's just, it fuels a metamorphosis of the human spirit. I think that's a cool analogy, and I thought that was a very, very interesting angle to go with.
What I really like, you know, I mean, you see as you get more and more in the book, the philosophical parts of the novel are really the discussion, the dialogues that happen between Diablo and Elizabeth.
Right. Yeah.
And this is really the crucial part of the book, because this is really the message, well, you know, the moral center.
Or Clovis and Diablo.
You mean Billy Pronto?
Because, well, yeah, same deal, same difference. But you know, those, there's a lot divulged in that too. Even though you have
yes.
to wade your way through and decipher what the hell he's saying, you know, it's very humorous. Now, I do have a question for you.
Oh, bring it!
Which may end up becoming a question for Tony Vigorito.
Okay.
As a linguist and being much more up to date with your grammar than I am.
You mean the English grammar?
Yes.
Okay.
What would you say about this phrase of no, it concerns what you're about to do? Would that not be referring to the future tense?
Oh, not linguistically.
Because linguistically, there is no future tense verb.
Nope. A hardcore linguist will tell you that in the English language, there is no present and there is no past tense. It's not necessarily true of every language, but the English language, for instance, has no past and no future. Everything in English is the present tense. What I mean by that, and I don't want to go too deep into it because, I mean, it's not the point of the show. But, for instance, if I give you, I went to the store, it's basically 0 plus ED. That's what we would use in linguistics. It's the 0 plus ED. So the ED is a form of the past, but it's not the past. I have gone is the past, is the present, sorry, which is have. Gone is what we call 0 plus EN. It's the present participle. And it's the same with the future. I will go. The verb is to go. What you have is just a particle that expresses the future. But in English, I mean, I know people are not going to agree because they think, well, I mean, that's not true. If I tell you I went to the store, then clearly it means the past.
It indicates the past.
It indicates the past. Linguistically, this is not true. If you go down into, linguistics, there's
throwing,
no past.
So then throwing linguistics out the window since it doesn't apply to the book because Clovis... You know, and of course, the whole reason we're talking about this at all, since we didn't explain ahead of time, for those who have not read the book, Clovis is the king of the wood.
Yes.
For most of the time we're reading about him, and calls himself Billy Pronto.
Mm-hmm. Well.
But he can only, if he wants to, he skips around time, and if he wants to remain in one time, then he can only speak in the present tense.
Yes.
If he speaks in any other tense, then he will not only lose his hold on that current time, but he'll never be able to stop himself again, is his theory anyway, because I don't see how that's possible, but it...
And the first time he moved his sword, which is the way that he, you know, goes into, you know, in between centuries, while yelling and screaming, whoa now, you know, moves around the his sword, and he ends up in the 21st century, and he likes it. But the thing is, he's also not really capable of controlling exactly where he's going.
Right.
So,
But he's better at controlling it than Jacob Jingleheimer.
Yes. But once he's been somewhere, then it's easier to go back. So he keeps going back and forth. And like I said earlier, people who are faced with him, like Diabolo will be, like JJ will be, they see him as what they want to see. So Diablo will see him as Billy Pronto, who was his jail guard.
Right.
And JJ Speed, that we'll talk about in a minute, sees him as himself because that's what he's obsessed about.
Right. But it's, regardless, Elizabeth sees him as what he is.
Yeah.
But he does refer to himself as Billy Pronto. My whole point is, that I'm one of those freaks that will watch Dirty Harry and count the number of bullets because he has the line, well, I can't remember whether I fired 5 or 6, so I will go through and count the bullets because I'm just one of those freaks. So when you set up a rule like that, like the guy can never break the present tense, and if he does, then he'll immediately be shoved out of that time period and be forced to move around. At the very end, he breaks the rule because he says he tells Diablo, you need to go into that. He's like, well, what are you talking about? And he says, it's what you're about to do. Mm-hmm. So he's referring to the future, which he is, by his own rules, not allowed to do, and nothing happens to him. Now, I like to think that Tony Vigorito did that on purpose.
Oh, you bet.
To show, because he says right after that, I mean, it's not like, it's the very next paragraph. he says there is only one moment,
mm-hmm.
and that is now. So it's not like Vigorito's forgotten his own rule.
Oh,
so,
no.
You know, I think he did it on purpose just to show the guy's full of crap. He doesn't know the rules any more than anybody else does.
But it's interesting because obviously, the you know, one of the main point of the text is to prove, you know, to show that there is only one moment and that
right.
only that very moment, the now, the here and now. And then he tells you that if you release control, you know, I mean, if you let go of your ego, you know.
Taoism.
Then you are going to be able to remember your future, which right. he repeats a couple of times in the text, which I think obviously is brilliant. And it's also very linked with quantum theory, you know. I mean, it is all these very famous, you know, theories of the moment, which is the world is only the imagination of, you know, people. You know, you imagine the world that you're in, that nothing exists outside of our imagination, nothing exists outside of our consciousness.
Well, so frankly, the man crams a lot of different things into one
yeah.
into one book. I mean, there's a lot of different philosophies
rich,
mixed
man.
Together into one book that all complement one another very well. I mean, he's discussing the divine feminine, and
yep.
I mean, he hits it all. I mean, it really doesn't leave very many stones unturned. So applause for that, because that's not exactly easy to do either.
But he also, and he plays obviously with the main themes, you know. I mean, J.J. Speed is, you know, your Jacob Jingleheimer?
Yes, Jacob Jingleheimer.
That's a hard one. Jacob Jingleheimer. He starts the novel as the priest, you know. I mean, he's how should I put it? He's sexually frustrated priest, you know.
He's a porn addict priest.
Yes, that's the idea. And, you know, so he's, you know, fervently against anything that has to do with sex because obviously it's, you know, his own pulsion that has been repressed. I mean, go to Freud, you know.
I guess the most appropriate way to title him is porn addict priest turned CIA lackey turned king of the wood fairy king.
But it is brilliant. It is absolutely brilliant because you have somebody who is obsessed with oneself, who really ends up doing exactly what he's always wanted to do, which is spy on everybody else and be the god
right. yes.
of
yes.
creation. You know, be the know-it-all, omnipresent eye on everybody. Like, and the CIA represents exactly that, you know.
No.
I mean, wiretapping and all this good stuff. And then he ends up, you know, king of the woods.
Now, I'm not going to steal your thunder because I don't want to sleep on the couch. And so I'll let you use your interject the literary reference that you have, which I think is a fine literary reference.
Which one?
But I love the whole the rain god who doesn't know he's a god.
Oh, that one is phenomenal.
I think that's very apropos to what's going on with,
I believe it's
with
in
JJ.
Oh, absolutely. I believe this is in the first book of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. If I remember well, I mean, it's been a while. I believe it's in the first book, so The Hitchhikers. And you have that character who's a truck driver. And I don't remember what his name is, but he's a truck driver. And he's very depressed, poor guy, because, I mean, he can look ahead and see that it's all nice and sunny. But everywhere he goes, it always rains on him, poor man. And he never, ever finds out that he happens to be the god of the rain. And this is exactly what J.J. Speed is all about.
You know, J.J. is, if Clovis is the positive aspect of chaos, then J.J. is the negative aspect of chaos.
Black hole.
And therefore, right, and therefore the universe perpetually shits on J.J. on a regular basis. And I know we're not supposed to swear, but forgive me, that's just the best way to say this. You know, in the immortal line from Basketball, it certainly seems to be raining shit on J.J. You know, on this guy. He's just crazy. And everything that can go wrong does for him. He just never, you know, it starts, and we should see it coming, frankly, as
oh, yeah.
readers, because one of the initial things we find out about J.J. Speed's past is that he was once on the game show Let's Make a Deal,
mm-hmm.
and he just had this impulse, which the entire book is about
impulse
and about following mm-hmm. impulse and how correct your yes. impulse will always be. And he had an impulse to choose door number whatever, And he did, and instead of winning the grand prize, he got one of the booby prizes of winning a lifetime supply of toothpicks. And so, and he said it was, you know, pretty much all downhill from there. You know, the rest of his life was just BS from then on. And that is the embodiment of that character.
You know, if you want to do another reference, you know, as I was reading the book, especially the second part, a reference that probably everybody has seen by now. You know, the last Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, the last one, the third one. As I was reading and as it, you know, delved more into, you know, personal interaction, interconnectability, you know, synchronicity and everything. Right. I kept getting flashes of that scene that apparently people didn't like, which I thought was fascinating.
I think they were weirded out by it.
You know, the, what's his name, Jack Sparrow, when he's on the boat himself at the end of the universe.
The entire crew is Jack.
Yeah, the entire crew is Jack, and he's really much talking to himself. And when the scene cuts, you see that he's actually talking to himself. There's nobody else there.
Right.
And I, you know, I mean, I had flashes of that scene all through the book, which I think is very, very interesting.
Well, you know, I somewhat enjoyed, but somewhat didn't, the interactions between Clovis and Diablo, where Diablo is trying to figure out, is Clovis a figment of his imagination? Is Diablo a figment of Clovis's imagination? Is one of them hallucinating the other one? And if so, who's hallucinating, you know, whom?
Yes.
And all of that kind of thing. I appreciated the humor in it and the fun of it, but yes. If I have to come up with a criticism of the book, I would say that ran a little long for me.
Oh, I loved it.
But because it's like, well, no, he's not. We already know he's not. And so as the reader, having already broken the fourth wall and knowing the information we already know, that ran a little long for me, but I did appreciate the humor of the scenario.
Which is, I mean, to go back to the initial point of the book, is all about impulse. The book is all about release. You know, it's all about, and you have that cult that, you know, starts coming pretty much early on in the book. And as it goes along, the what?
M2.
And their motto, you know, I mean, they touch the side of their nose and they look at you and they say, walk away. And, you know, and you wonder, I was wondering for a moment, you know. What does it mean? Walk away from what? I mean, basically, it's walk away from yourself, you know, walk away from all that society has forced you to be, you know.
Because it's all BS. I mean, that's the idea, is that this is all a line you've been fed and swallowed without realizing that it was just a line. You know, you've been lied to and you swallowed the lie and conformed. And instead, maybe what you should do is just walk away from that and just let it be whatever it is and you be whatever you want to be instead.
And this is why I really, really enjoy, and I mean, I don't want to divulge too much, but it happens at the beginning of the book, so I'm going to spoil too much. But I really like the way Vigorito portrays the birth of Elizabeth.
Right.
And you have that, you know, full of life woman whose name is Bridget Snapdragon, just because she wants to be called Snapdragon, and she just falsified the documents just to keep the name. And she, you know, you are fed through society that you're supposed to behave a certain way and you're supposed to feel a certain amount of things. So when you give birth as a woman, you are, according to Vigorito, supposed to feel pain because that's what people have been telling you. Well, this woman is orgasming during her birth, you know, because it's a celebration of life. It's a celebration of joy and empowerment. If you want, you're giving life, you should be happy. And what better way to express your happiness and content than having an orgasm?
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I mean, another big element which he repeats over and over and over again is obviously the concept of synchronicity.
Right.
That to me is fascinating because he does not exactly use a theory that is newsflash. It's a theory that everything is connected, everything that you do has got a consequence, that you are not separate from the universe and from each other, that you are one and one thing. And I love he plays with word beautifully. And as a linguist, I must admit that, let's be honest, it turns me on. So he works with the word coincidence, you know.
Watch it, Tony. Got my eyes on you.
And coincidence is exactly that. You know, what's a coincidence? An incidence, so it's two things happening at the same time.
Right.
Well, duh, you know, everything happens in the same time, here and now. I love that theory.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that passage and that play with words.
Yeah, and speaking of words and speaking of, you know, words and identity and stuff, it's very interesting the way that he takes it a step further and saying that society not only traps us in, you know, forcing us to believe a certain set of rules, but also we are locked in the way people see us. He's not the first one to say that. I mean, Sartre before him in the 40s and 50s have said exactly that, that we cannot become a subject unless we become the object of the gaze of the other. You know, I mean, this is not a new concept. Right. This is highly philosophical.
Well, and we can go even further back than that and go to the whole, you know, if a tree falls in the woods, there's nobody there to hear it, does it make a sound?
Exactly.
I mean, it's all the same. All the same style of thinking.
Exactly. And, you know, the identity, like we are nobody unless somebody names us. You know, there's plenty of books that have played with that theme, but
Ishmael.
Ishmael, absolutely. And he takes it, you know, pretty deep. I like that.
Well, and there are those that say, you know, you go to Shakespeare, what's in a name? Then there are those who would say that there is no name but the one you give yourself. Then there are those, like in this book, that would say, you know, because you see both in this book, frankly. You see the one angle that says, you know, I should be named whatever I want to be named and not what someone else names me. But then you also have the opposing opinion, which is that, you know, I am the only name I have is the name I am given.
Yes.
Because that's all names are anyway, is someone else's label for us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I must admit there are a couple of people in my life that I do not know their name. And I know them on sight and I know them by personality.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know their name. And the reason I don't know their name, frankly, is because they're deaf and it just never came up in conversation.
Yeah.
Because it's a different kind of conversation you have with a deaf person. And they just never introduced themselves, and I just never thought to ask their name. And they're not, you know, close friends, so I don't need their name. And frankly, I don't miss that knowledge either. I know who they are. I don't need to know what they're called. And so that I was struck by that thought while I was reading.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the last point that I would like to bring is the significance of the mistletoe. I don't know much about it, except that it's a Christmas.
It's poisonous.
It's poisonous. You kiss under it, you know.
Yeah.
But here in the book, you know, it's interesting that he takes it, which is, you know, I'm assuming some kind of a pagan symbol. And And he takes it as a tree of life. How very interesting. Like, if you touch the mistletoe,
right.
Clovis, you know, carries the mistletoe around. But if you touch the, what is it called? The bow of mistletoe?
The bow
of mistletoe, then you will die. How very interesting. You know, so like I said, I'm not fully sure of the symbolism in it, but it's potent in that book.
It is. And, you know, it's, you know, I'm looking it up right now. It's a very prominent plant in mythology and legend and all of those things. You can find it in Egyptian. You can find it in Greek, Roman mythology. You can find it in the Celtic traditions. It is all over, you know, ancient religions that predate Christianity and the more predominant Western religions.
Absolutely.
Of today. That it was seen as a remedy for barrenness, you know, that it was used as a fertility drug.
Yep.
It was used as an antidote to poison.
Mm-hmm.
It is poisonous itself, which is why it would work in that way.
Sure.
It's just, there's a lot of references to it.
Absolutely.
Throughout mythology.
So all in all, a wonderful book. I mean, a book that really focuses on experience. You know, I mean, like I said, he's not new at going with that. You know, I mean, you go back to Rousseau, you go back to the 18th century, you know, philosophers. It's all about experience. It's all about, you know, put yourself out there. But it's an interesting message that basically, in order to change, it just takes one person. You know, if one person and another person, like one by one, you can break down the walls of, you know, the crap society is trying to feed you. You know, so it's not a daunting message. You know, I mean, Ishmael, when I read it, I felt totally flabbergasted, but it felt to me also that what he was advocating was really hard to achieve.
Yes.
Here it feels like it's doable. Like you just need to change your perception. Just follow your impulse, you know, experience, enjoy life. And by doing it, because everything is synchronized and everything is interconnected, then it will affect the person next to you. You know, I mean, it reminds me of this commercial that I adore, which is that commercial, I don't remember if it's an insurance or whatever, that somebody does something good and then somebody sees it and then does something good themselves to another person
pay it forward.
Absolutely. And I think this is a message to everybody that can actually be achieved for once.
Well, except that it, you know, I would say that it definitely differs from the pay it forward concept in that you could steal from the person. Whereas pay it forward is only, you know, helping others, which this is not about helping others. This is about being unique and being individualistic and not following the herd. You know, and because there are many instances of people in the book that they'll just take something out of somebody's grocery cart and then just, you know, point at their, you know, with their, from, you know, do the whole nose sign from the sting and say, walk away.
Just, you know, be yourself, you know,
and
you don't have
yeah,
to.
Where it's like, you know, why all these rules and regulations to how to live? Just do what your impulse tells you to do and everything will be fine. You know, I did appreciate the, like, there's the passage in the book that talks about Diablo has come to the realization that money is really only a means to an end,
mm-hmm.
and that he doesn't mind earning money. It's not counterproductive to indulge in that area of society as long as you don't place importance on it. And I found that interesting because that would be counter to a book like Ishmael, you know, which would say, get rid of wealth, get rid of anything like that because it is just subjugative, you know, and will enslave you rather than do anything positive at all. Whereas this was just more of a, hey, you know, it's just as unimportant as everything else. And that, you know.
But that's the thing. And, you know, like I said, Ishmael was here for us to change society. This guy is saying you cannot change society. It's already ingrained. But what you can do is change yourself.
Right.
You know, one day at a time, one person at a time. So it's attainable.
So I find that interesting. You know, it's one of the characters is revolutionary in Diablo. But most of the characters, you know, like, say, Elizabeth,
uh-huh.
who is frankly more in tune with the philosophy than Diablo is, says no. You know, basically her character is not revolutionary in the least bit. I don't care if people evolve or not.
Mm-hmm.
That's their business. I'm only interested in me.
And all you have to do is be nine kinds of naked.
Right. And when, you know, she finally responds on impulse, of course, to his, you know, Diablo's indecision on what to do with fuck everybody else, save yourself.
Yeah.
And that is the epitome of this whole impulse thing that, you know, it sounds, when it's out of context like that, it sounds like it's a very selfish statement that only look out for yourself and nobody else. But in reality, what it is, the whole concept is that there is no everybody else.
Yep.
It's all one entity to begin with, and we're all just different manifestations of the same consciousness. And so it, by looking out for yourself, you are looking out for everyone else.
That's the idea.
So a very, very interesting.
And the title is extremely significant. Sorry.
For you to say. Significative. what was that word? Significant?
So that was a French word. Sorry, just slipped.
Oh, I see.
Significant, I guess. It really means something, all right?
You got to think of her.
And
brainificate.
So he's not, you know, I mean, I'm not going to explain what it is because it comes at the end, but it means something. And it's, you know, once again, it's an embodiment of the whole message. So be nine kinds of naked
now
people.
Before we go, I did want to say that there was a, in the original cast of Saturday Night Live, they did a sketch where it was a spoof on the famous film Citizen Kane.
Uh-huh.
And of course, for those who have not seen Citizen Kane, there's a long-running mystery through the movie, because the man's last words were Rosebud.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's trying to figure out what he meant by that.
Yeah.
So the spoof is that the man's last words were Rosebud Henri with mustard, which is just that people misunderstood what he said, and really what he said was roast beef on rye with mustard, and that's what he wanted to eat. And then he died.
Yeah.
And so that's the way I saw cherry shit in the book, and I thought it was hilarious. You know, it just instantly reminded me of that Saturday Night Live sketch of, you know, she said a very poignant...
Bridget.
You know, Bridget Snapdragon had a very poignant last words. You know, her phrase was wonderful and something that he definitely should, you know, her husband Dave should hold on to for the rest of his life and definitely keep that phrase in mind. But instead, he misunderstood what she said as cherish it. Instead of cherish it. And I just... I applaud Vigorito for something that I will laugh about for months.
I caught it, though, when he said that.
And she did. She wrote a note in the book with a question mark, so I knew she didn't already know. Where she said, cherish it?
Cherish it? Like, are you trying to say cherish it? So beautiful book. Absolutely wonderful. You know, if you want a deep read and at the same time something that is absolutely hilarious at time, when the jokes are phenomenal, where you can play with the language, you know, you can play with words, definitely Nine Kinds of Naked is a book for you.
Yeah, absolutely fabulous. Loved it. Can't recommend it enough.
Oh, yeah.
What's up next?
Druids.
Next time, Druids by Morgan Llewellyn.
Yes. For next month, I think we're going to go a little bit more ethnic, for lack of a better word. You know,
okay.
We're going to go literature that is for, I mean, I don't want to use the word minority because it's so politically inclined, but, you know, groups that are less big than other groups, you know, whatever you want to say it. So Druids is the first one we're going to be reading. It's the story of a young boy who lives, you know, in the Gaul, you know, long, long time ago, and how he becomes a druid, and, you know,
this would be what they're now calling historical fiction.
Yeah, that's the idea. It's a great story.
Loosely based on, mostly from what I understand, the autobiographical journals of Julius Caesar in his conquest of the Gauls.
Yes.
Fabulous book. So looking forward
really
to reviewing
good book.
That.
Really good book.
So yeah, again, that book is Druids by Morgan Llewellyn, however you pronounce that properly. I'm sure I'm murdering it. But this book was Nine Kinds of Naked that we reviewed today by Tony Vigorito. Once again, go buy it today.
Go buy it.
If
go
you don't
read it.
Already own it, go buy it today. Read it. And apply it.
And send us an email if you liked it and talk to us about it, because we'd like to talk to people, you know?
They can't send us an email. They don't have an email address.
Oh, we don't?
So
okay.
Just go to the forum
okay.
at spookylogistics.com. Join up there.
Uh-huh.
And then respond in our section of the forum.
Yes. He is Fizz.
Pretty much anywhere.
I am Ailey Hutt, if you want to
put
talk
it anywhere
with us.
In there. I mean, there's the study and the parlor, you know, in areas like that. Just go in there into the ink and quill section and tell us that you like the book and, you know, start discussing.
Yes.
All right. Thanks, folks. That's been our show. We will see you next time here on Ink and Quill.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Ink and Quill. Tune in next time and hear Dr. Hot say...
Well, let me tell you, there is absolutely nothing magical about beans, and they're certainly not a fruit.
Ink and Quill, turning literature inside out.